Thank you, Mr. Salvadori. Appreciate that special music. Wonderful Sabbath to everyone. Seems like this time of the year, the sun's coming through off the snow. I can barely see you. I think that's a good thing or not a good thing. I'm not sure. As mentioned, tomorrow is the Passover service. We think about Christ's sacrifice. We understand through a reading of the scriptures that it's with his death and resurrection that replaces the Old Testament sacrificial system. And I can imagine it was quite the spectacle. But if you can imagine both in the sojourning in the wilderness as well as when the temple was established in Jerusalem, the noise that was going on as different animals were brought to the temple to be sacrificed or being sold to, so that those who may not have had flocks or herds could also sacrifice an animal. I think it's kind of interesting. I haven't owned too many animals in my life. I think the closest thing I've had is maybe a guinea pig, and I don't see that listed in Leviticus. But people would raise animals and take them to. And what lessons can we learn from the Old Testament sacrifice? Yes, we know and understand that the sacrificial system was replaced. But what sacrifices or offerings were established? Why were they established? And as well, are there any lessons that can be applied in our lives today as New Testament or New Covenant Christians? So today I would like to review the Old Testament sacrifices, I guess more specifically the ones that were established in Leviticus, and then as well in the context of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, as we think about the Passover season and Christ's sacrifice here in the next couple of days. First, we need to have a reminder of what sin does. Why the sacrificial system to begin with? Sin, our transgression of the law, separates us from God. Let's look at Isaiah chapter 59 and verse 2. Isaiah chapter 59 and verse 2. But your iniquities have made a separation between you and your God, and your sins have hidden his face from you so that he does not hear. As we know, God wants to have a relationship with us. He wanted to have a relationship with Old Testament Israel. And it's our sin that separates us from God, removes us, hides God's face from us so that he does not hear. To be in a position where we think our Creator is not hearing us. I remember being young. I don't remember too many instances from my early childhood, but I remember being lost, not knowing where mom and dad were. And I remember crying out and very upset and very frustrated because they weren't responding. They weren't listening to me. As a Christian, that's not also a pleasant feeling if we have a perspective that our God does not hear us. But that's what sin does. A major part of the beginning of Genesis recounts the effect of sin on the relationship between man and God. Adam and Eve's decisions and what it did with their relationship with God. No longer were they allowed to be in the Garden of Eden. They were put away. They were shunned. They were separated. And we see through the relationship of Cain and Abel and through the early human beings up to the point where only Noah was found to be in favor. Everyone else and their sins and their actions had separated their relationship, separated themselves from God. So with that separation, we need reconciliation to bring the two parties together. And that's what a sacrifice does. That is what a living being and the loss of a life does. In the Old Testament, it was a life of an animal. And as we understand from the New Covenant, it's the life of our elder brother, Jesus Christ. Let's look at Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 11. It's one thing that kind of stands out when people think of the Old Testament. Judaism, especially traditional Judaism, is a sacrificial system. And a belief and a view that the sacrificial system, in essence, was the religion. But it wasn't. Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 11. But when Christ appeared as high priest of the good things to come, he entered in through the greater and more perfect tabernacle not made with hands, that is to say, not of this creation, and not through the blood of goats and calves, but through his own blood. He entered the holy place once and for all, having obtained eternal redemption. For if the blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer, sprinkling those who have been defiled, sanctify for the cleansing of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? Obviously, those bulls, those calves, those sheep, those turtle doves, those lambs, those goats had no choice in their fate. However, our older brother not only had the choice, but he made the choice to serve. 15, verse 15, for this reason, he is the mediator of a new covenant, so that since a death has taken place through the redemption of the transgressions that were committed under the first covenant, those who have been called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. For where a covenant is, there must of necessity be the death of the one who made it. For a covenant, or a testament, a covenant is valid only when men are dead, for it is never enforced while the one who made it lives. Therefore, even the first covenant was not inaugurated without blood. For when every commandment had been spoken by Moses to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of the calves and of the goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, "This is the blood of the covenant which God commanded you." And in the same way, he sprinkled both the covenant and all the vessels of the ministry with the blood. And according to the law, and one may also say, all these things are cleansed with blood, and without shedding of blood there is no forgiveness. Therefore, it was necessary for the copies of these things in heavens to be cleansed with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ did not enter a holy place made with hands, a mere copy of the true one, but into heaven itself, now to appear the presence of God for us. Nor was it that he would offer himself often as the high priest enters the holy place year by year with the blood that is not his own. Otherwise, he would have needed to suffer often since the foundation of the world. Now, once at the consummation of the ages, he has been manifested to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And as much, it is appointed for men to die once, and this comes judgment. So Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time for the salvation without reference to sin to those who eagerly await him. There's a few things to note as we read this passage. The sacrifices and the rituals were a part of the Old Covenant, but only a part. As we just read in putting these scriptures together, because there has been transgression, there is need of one to die for blood to be offered. And with this, our sin separating us from God, there is a need for a sacrifice to bring reconciliation. And that is what, in the Old Testament and under the Old Covenant, that is what the sacrifices did. It brought reconciliation. That was the purpose of the sacrifices. It wasn't the religion itself. The religion and what, as we shall read later, what God wanted was not a sacrificial system. The sacrificial system was required as part of the covenant. And as part of the new covenant, there is also a need for a death. There's need for blood. And the blood being our elder Savior, as we just read, to bring and to reconcile us to God. But our faith, our belief, our religion is so much more than that. What God expects from us is so much more than that. But the first part, the starting point, is a need to be reconciled to God, as we just read. So as we think about these Old Testament and Old Covenant rituals, and what we can learn, we can start turning back to the book of Leviticus. There's a few additional things to keep in mind as we before we look at the actual sacrifices. A few things. First of all, is that the instructions were exact. The instructions that were given through Moses to the nation were exact, how they were to do it. It's interesting to note that when God gives his way, he can often be very exacting in his requirements. And there's a reason why. Often it's the way it needs to be done to make it work, or maybe it's a lesson that he is trying to give through a physical act, that we have a spiritual lesson that helps us to understand his way and his plan, his law. In this case, chapters 1 through 5 are specific instructions on how the offerings were to be brought. And then in chapters 6 and 7, there's some additional instructions to the priests on how they were to manage the sacrifices. They're very specific. And I believe it's an important lesson for us that even under the New Covenant, in the New Testament, there are instructions that God gives us. It's not left to us to say, this is how we should honor God, or it's up to us on choices we make to make things holy. No, God makes things holy. God provides instructions, and it's us to implement those instructions. Another thing to keep in mind is that the people participated in the Old Covenant reconciliation. As we shall see as we go through these sacrifices, those bringing the animal or bringing the flour and the meal to the altar did not simply bring it and leave, and then it was up to the priests. So one thing, growing up, I never was really clear to me. I always thought that it was the priests that were responsible for doing the sacrificing. But as we shall read, there is an active participation required by the offerer. And it's not simply a process of dropping it off to the priests. So I've done my job. And another thing to note is that there were three participants in the offering. There were three participants. The offerer, the intermediary, which was the priest, and then the receiver, God. In each case, there were these three partakers, if you will, of the offering. So with some of that background, let's now look at these Old Testament sacrifices and some of the lessons that we can learn and reflect on with the New Covenant method of reconciliation. The five offerings described in Leviticus chapters 1 through 5, and then once again additional instructions in 6 and 7, there were five offerings. There was the burnt offering, the grain or meal offering was the second offering, and for those of you who still read the New King James Version, you'll see it as a meat offering. That was another thing that was a bit confusing to me. I always thought the meat offering, it dealt once again with something from the herd or the flock. But no, it should be more better translated meal or grain offering. The third offering was the peace offering, then followed by the sin offering and the trespass offering. So five different offerings that were given. Each had its own purpose, its own, in essence, routine. The first three offerings were considered an offering. Sin and guilt were not involved. It's another misconception. is that when you think about the offerings, all the offerings were offered because of transgression. That's not the case. The first three offerings that were provided, the burnt offering, the grain offering, and the peace offering, were offered with a sweet savor to God, and it was not involving sin or transgression. But it was offered, the sacrifice or the offering was to looking for acceptance and atonement from God. And we'll dig into that here in a bit more. The last two offerings, the sin and the trespass, then were as a result of sin or some type of transgression. So the first offering, we can get into a bit more detail here. If you look at Leviticus 1, Leviticus chapter 1 and verse 1, then the Eternal called to Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when any man of you brings an offering to the Eternal, you shall bring your offerings of the animals from the herd or the flock, herd being large animals, flock being small animals. If his offering is a burnt offering from the herd, he shall offer it a male without defect. He shall offer it in the doorway of the tent of the meeting, that it may be accepted before the Eternal. The offering, the first offering, once again, it was a sweet savor offering, not as a result of sin. Let's look at a few things. Verse 4, he shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering, that it may be accepted for him to make atonement on his behalf. He shall slay the young bull, in this case, because it was brought from the herd. He shall slay the young bull, or one of the herd, before the Eternal. And Aaron's sons of the priest shall offer up the blood and sprinkle the blood around on the altar that is in the doorway of the tent of the meeting. It was a few things. First of all, it was, once again, brought by the offerer. The offerer himself would place hands on the animal, and then the offerer himself would slay the animal. It wasn't the priest that would slay the animal. It was the offerer himself. So once again, there was active participation. Another thing to note is that, as we just read in verse 4, it was offered that it may be accepted for him to make atonement on his behalf. We often think of atonement, whether it be the Feast of Atonement or the concept of atonement, is, well, we've sinned and we want to atone. We understand through the Feast of Atonement and the concept of atonement is much, much broader than that. It's not necessarily dealing with sin. Yes, it can. As a result of sin, you think you're separated from God, but that's what the reconciliation, the sacrifice of reconciliation to bring back to God. The concept of atonement is that we want to be accepted or at one with God. We are looking for His acceptance, and that we want His acceptance. It's not so much a tit for tat, that I bring something, therefore, God, you have to accept me. But what God is looking for is the act and the attitude of wanting to be at one with God. The offering was a life, was an animal. Life was taken. The other thing interesting to note from the burnt offering is that, as we see, and we can't get through the whole chapter, or pretty much would spend one sermon per offering here. But as it, reading down through the first chapter, is that there were different offerings that someone could bring for a burnt offering. It wasn't just a bull. You could also bring something from a flock, and then also a turtle dove. Verse 14. So the concept of the burnt offering in offering something for atonement to God was available to everyone. The old, the young, the rich, the poor. And that was offered. And it's, you think of the concept or some of the analogies or the applications from a New Covenant standpoint or New Testament standpoint, the widow's mite. where Jesus Christ talked about the attitude that was brought by someone with a mite and what God can do with that type of an attitude. And we see once again we see the concept with this burnt offering that if we're looking for atonement, we want to bring our best. We want to bring our most powerful and most valuable possession that we have and give the most that we can to God, whether it be a bull or whether it be a turtle dove. That God looks upon that heart. Something else to note from the burnt offering is that it was wholly burnt, a total offering. The offerer or the priest was not to partake. Holy, dedicated to God, the burnt offering, symbolizing our commitment, our dedication, offering our whole self to God and looking for that relationship and that union with God, atonement. So that's the burnt offering. In chapter 2, we see the next offering, the type of offering that was provided. The grain or the meal offering. Once again, in the King James Version, it says meat offering, but not the best translation. Chapter 2 of verse 1, Leviticus, now when anyone presents a grain offering as an offering to the Eternal, his offering shall be a fine flour, and he shall pour oil on it and put frankincense on it, and as we see later, also salt. A few things to note about this grain offering. First of all, it was, once again, prepared by the offerer. And it was made up of fine flour. The fine flour was to be beaten, ground, made fine, representing Christ's beating. Once again, when you think about the detail that was offered in these offerings, I can't imagine that everyone would understand, well, why does he want me to do this? You know, why does God want me to bring flour that's beaten? Or as we see in verse 4, they were to be unleavened. No leaven was to be added. Why? Why not? But at that time, it's respecting God's instructions and that there is a meaning to it. And he has meaning. Why leavening was not to be added. Symbolizing, obviously, the greater picture of understanding of putting sin out of our lives, pictured by these days. In verse 3, then we read, the remainder of the grain offering belongs to Aaron and his son, the thing most holy of the offerings to the Eternal by fire. So in this case, this offering was to be partially consumed by the Levites. For the first offering, the burnt offering, it was wholly consumed on the altar. None of it was to be partaken or to be eaten by the Levites. But in this case, it was to be consumed by the Levites. Verse 4, now when you bring an offering of a grain offering baked in the oven, it shall be unleavened cakes of fine flour mixed with oil and unleavened wafers spread with oil. For offering is a grain offering made on the griddle. So there's different types, by the way, of the meal offering. It could be prepared different ways, but pretty much with the same ingredients. Verse 8, when you bring in the grain offering which is made of these things to the Eternal, it shall be presented to the priests, and he shall bring it to the altar. Verse 9, then the priest shall take up the grain offering, its memorial portion, and shall offer it up in smoke on the altar as an offering of a fire, of a soothing aroma to the Eternal. The remainder of the grain offering belongs to Aaron and his sons, a thing most holy of the offering to the Eternal. This offering was an offering of the first fruits. So, obviously, in agricultural society, most everyone grew, and the offerer was to bring their first fruits to the altar. The first offering, none of it was to be consumed. First offering, partially consumed by the Levites. And the difference between these two is that, obviously, in the, as we already mentioned, the burnt offering, the life was offered to God. In this offering, it's partial. It's we have first fruits. We have something to provide, and the offer was to share with the Levites. So where the first offering, the burnt offering, was atonement with God and acceptance with God, now the second offering began to expand, still bringing our best, our fine flour, our best oil, properly made, but then shared with the Levites. And what we do in our first fruits and what we have to provide goes beyond ourselves and our relationship with God, but now with a broader audience. Still note, though, that in this case, the offer was not to partake. Just a priest, an offering, obviously the offering to God. The third type of the savor offering, or the sweet savor offering, was the peace offering. Read in verse in chapter 3. Chapter 3 of Leviticus. Now, if his offering is a sacrifice of peace offerings, if he is going to offer out of the herd, whether male or female, he shall offer it without defect before the Eternal. He shall lay his hand on the head of his offspring, slay it in the doorway of the tent of the meeting, and Aaron's sons, the priests, shall sprinkle the blood around on the altar. From the sacrifice of the peace offering, he shall present an offering by fire to the Eternal, the fat that covers the entrails, and the fat there is on the entrails, and the two kidneys with the fat that is on them, which is on the loins, and the lobe of the liver, which he shall remove from the kidneys. Then Aaron's son shall offer it up in the smoke on the altar of the burnt offering, which is on the wood that is on the fire. It is an offering by fire of a soothing aroma to the Eternal. I'm not sure what burning kidneys smell like. Of course, obviously, God's view is different than ours, and his sense of smell is different than ours. I can't say about a smell, but to God, it is a sweet savor. A few items to note as well from this is, once again, it was slain by the offerer. The offerer laid the hands on, so you see that participation. The priest then did their work, but if you combine, and for the sake of time, we won't get into the specifics, but if we combine then what we see from chapters 6 and 7 with this, is that now the difference between this offering, our free will offering, and the first two, is in this case, all three partook. God, through the offering. Secondly, the sons took a portion. And then the third was the offerer himself partook. So in this sweet offering to God, we now see all three involved. And I believe this pictures, as you know, the first one was with God alone, the second one was now extended to the priest, and now it's all three participating. It's reflective of that whole relationship of the priest, now our high priest, God, and us, all three partaking. We understand how much this, and it had to be eaten that day, by the way. If it wasn't eaten by that day, then actually it said that the offerer or the priest were transgressing. It had to be eaten that day. So this concept of fellowshipping, this concept of breaking bread, we see repeated so much through the New Testament, whether it be Christ's return and the wedding supper. Even for your notes in Luke 22:15, that Christ said it, when he was talking to his disciples as they were preparing the Passover meal, he said, "I desire to eat this Passover with them." He wanted that last meal together with his disciples. In this concept of partaking and sharing and breaking bread and eating a meal together, is emphasized by this third type of a sweet savor offering to God. Is a desire. So, first three offerings, once again, are a sweet savor offering. Two of them are a blood offering, a life was taken. One, a grain offering. But each represents something different and a relationship between the people and our Creator. Let's continue on then. And now look at the first offering that was to be provided as a result of a person's actions or of transgression. And that would be the sin offering, chapter 4. Chapter 4, then the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, if a person sins unintentionally in any of these things which the Eternal has commanded not to be done, and commits any of them, if the anointed priest sins so as to bring guilt on the people, then let him offer to the Eternal a bull without defect as a sin offering for the sin he has committed." The first point is, this is not a sweet savor offering. Nowhere in the fourth and the fifth, when the aroma comes off of the altar, is the aroma described as a sweet savor. This is not a sweet savor offering. Sin is not sweet, nor is the penalty in God's eyes. The first offerings were a pleasure to God because they represented someone who wanted to reach out. Someone who wanted to atone, to grow closer to Him. Or through their actions, grow closer to the body or as a group. That is a sweet savor. God has no pleasure in sin offerings or in the penalty of the sin. Also note in verse 2, and it's repeated throughout the chapter, that these were unintentional sins. Maybe unintentional, but needless to say, transgressions against God's law, whether it be intentional or unintentional, is the same result. It's the same separation. It's the same death penalty. But in this case, in this fourth offering we're covering, the sin offering, it's intentional sin. The offerer, once again, lays hands on the animal, symbolic of the animal being the substitute for the offerer. The unintentional sin does not only apply to the individual. Let's look at verse 13. "Now if the whole congregation of Israel commits error, and the matter escapes the notice of the assembly, and he commits any of these things which the Lord has commanded not to be done, and they become guilty, when the sin which they have committed becomes known, then the assembly shall offer a bull of the herd for a sin offering and bring it before the tent of the meeting." A group of people collectively sinning. We always think about our transgressions and our the offering and Christ's sacrifice applying to us individually. We often don't think about the concept that we as a congregation can also sin. We've had a dialogue over the last month or two about things that we may collectively need to improve. It's interesting because it's not thinking or looking at one particular person or saying that one particular person or two particular people but collectively as a congregation we can sin. But also collectively as a congregation, in the concept of the Old Testament, the Old Covenant, is that an offering could be made. In this case, it was the elders coming together, and the elders of the elders, not as in the priests, but elders as in the leaders of the congregation, or leaders, the leaders of the congregation of Israel would come together. They would lay hands on the animals, then they would slay the animals, and then offer and provide to the priests. And it's not only individuals, and it's not only the congregation, but let's now look at verse 22. And we already read in verse 3. When a leader sins and unintentionally does any one of these things which the Eternal, his God, has commanded not to be done, and he becomes guilty. It kind of goes against his concept of, you know, of the infallibility of a leader, a physical leader, that they can make no decisions wrong. We see quite the opposite, that a leader can sin. Or a priest, the minister, can sin. And there was also availability for those individuals to offer as a result of their unintentional sin once it is known. Another point to note on the sin offering in verse 6, and the priest shall dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle some of the blood 7 times before the internal in front of the veil of the sanctuary. This was not done with the sweet savor offerings. This was done for the sin offering, and as we'll see here with the transgress offering, where the blood was sprinkled towards the Holy of Holies, towards the sanctuary. And I believe that entails the greater need that you move from an offering of a free will offering to realize that there's a transgression. And that relationship with the Holy of Holies, and where the Spirit, or where the God of the Old Testament resided and dwelled, and where the high priest could only go in once a year. But that's different in this case, with the sin offering. Something else to note with the sin offering in verse 12. Verse 11, but the hide of the bull and all its flesh with its head and its legs and its entrails and its refuse, that is all the rest of the bull, he is to bring out to a clean place outside the camp where the ashes are poured out, and burn it on wood with fire. Where the ashes are poured out, it shall be burned. This is also different. When in the sweet savor offerings, everything was kept at the altar and burnt at the altar. In this case, the sin offering, in essence, the leftovers, were then to be taken outside the camp to clean spots and then burnt. And this can signify to me a number of different things. As we think about what's left over after our sacrifice, in essence, Jesus Christ, it was taken to Calvary. Outside, away from the temple. And this signified that where we dwell and where we congregate and where we worship, that as a result of the sacrifice, as a result of us going through and now Jesus Christ on our behalf saying, there's transgression, and I'm bringing an offering, I'm bringing a sacrifice as a result of my transgression, then what's left over? The remnants are just taken away. They're not to be cupped around. They're not to carry them as baggage. They're not to be reminders of you walk by and say, oh yeah, that's a result of when I, My view, my take on this is God saying, take it outside. You've offered. The sacrifice is there. Jesus Christ, your elder brother, has given his life. That's the action. Now take it outside. Don't keep it around as a reminder. I don't specifically read that, but I believe that's one of the key lessons that we learn from here. And that's different with the sin offering as opposed to the three sweet savor offerings. So then the last offering, and the offering four was the sin offering, the unintentional sin. The seventh offering then is the guilt offering. We see that in chapter 5. Chapter 5. Now if a person sins after he hears a public adjuration to testify when he is a witness, whether he has seen or otherwise known, if he does not tell it, then he will bear his guilt. Or if a person touches any unclean thing, whether a carcass of an unclean beast or a carcass of an unclean cattle or a carcass of an unclean swimming things, if it is hidden from him and he is unclean, then he will be guilty. If he touches human uncleanliness or whatever sort his uncleanliness may be, with which he becomes unclean and is hidden from him, then he comes to know it, he will be guilty. Or if a person swears thoughtlessly with his lips to do evil or to do good, in whatever manner a man may speak thoughtlessly with an oath, and it is hidden from him, and then he comes to know it, he will be guilty in one of these. So it shall be, when he becomes guilty in one of these, then he shall confess that in which he has sinned. And also, chapter 6 goes on where the Eternal as well says to Moses some additional things. What would happen if a person sins and acts unfaithfully against the Eternal as well as against a companion? And he talks about whether there be a robbery or lying or swearing falsely. So these are transgressions where we may say in chapter or the fourth sacrifice that was covered in chapter 4 was unintentional sinning against God's laws, doing something we should have done or we didn't do that we should have done or we did do what we shouldn't have done. But the fifth sacrifice, the trespass sacrificing, is more like a wrong done against a neighbor or a wrong done against a neighbor, therefore against God. It's an act of evil behavior against God or a neighbor. This differs from the sin offering, which was unintentional. But same thing that we see with this particular offering, actively offered by the person who had transgressed. They laid hands, representing that the animal was to take their position. The offerer would slay it. The priest would dip their finger and sprinkle it towards the Holy of Holies. And then the rest would be taken outside. But there's one additional thing that's noted in chapter 6, in verse 4. Then it shall be, when he sins and becomes guilty, that he shall restore what he took by robbery, or what he got by extortion, or the deposit which was entrusted to him, or the lost thing which he found, or if anything about which he swore falsely, he shall make restitution for it in full, and add to it 1/5 more. He shall give it to the one to whom it belongs on the day he presents his guilt offering. Then he shall bring to the priest his guilt offering to the Eternal, a ram without defect from the flock, according to your valuation for a guilt offering. And the priest shall make atonement for him before the Eternal, and he will be forgiven for any one of these things which he may have done to incur guilt. So it was to make restitution. The offer was to set it straight. In this case, adding 1/5 more. The two types of need for this sacrifice, either unintentional sin or transgressing and a need to make right, both required an offering, a sacrifice, to be reconciled. As we understand, as we read before, that the physical things fade away to the spiritual things, but the physical things are there to instruct and to teach, and for us to better understand the spiritual things and Christ's sacrifice. And in this case, when we talk about the sin of the unintentional, it's still God's law, and it's still transgression against God's law. In today's culture, in today's self-justification, there's a belief of, it doesn't matter what I do, because I have Christ's sacrifice. And as long as I don't hurt anybody, looking at these two sacrifices, I don't see that that's what God is teaching from a physical standpoint here. And I don't see anything that matches it from a scriptural standpoint from the New Testament. I see quite the opposite. I see quite the opposite, where we're not hurting anyone. Yes, we're hurting ourselves because we're separating ourselves from God. Yes, we're hurting God. There's no definition of, well, if I hurt somebody, then that's an issue. Then there's a problem. But if I don't, if I'm doing what I choose to do and I'm not hurting anyone, then that's okay. No, as we see, there were two specific offerings that were required of the Old Testament, of the old nation. Pointing, and once again, these offerings point us to Christ's sacrifice. But the lessons that God's giving through these Old Covenant sacrifices still apply, even though the need to physically do them are no longer there. To me, this is very clear evidence, especially young people who have to face this argument and this pressure, this peer pressure that, well, what does it matter if I'm not hurting anyone? Unintentional sin, an unintentional trespass, an unintentional sin is still sin that requires reconciliation. So those are the five sacrifices, the Old Testament sacrifices, the burnt, the meal, the peace, the sin, and the trespass offering. So what about the New Testament application? Let's look at Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 1. I had a quick start there for a moment. I thought that I'd been going on for way too long, and I remember we started at 2:30 and not 2. Of course, some of you still may think that I've been going on way too long, but we're coming close. Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 1. For the law, since it is only a shadow of the good things to come and not the very form of things, can never by the same sacrifices which they offer continually year by year make perfect those who draw near. Otherwise, would they not have ceased to be offered, because the worshippers, having once been cleansed, would no longer have had consciousness of sins. But in those sacrifices there is a reminder of sins year by year, for it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. So the sacrifices had to be repeated year after year and time after time and week after week and as required. When there was a sin offering or need to do a trespass offering, it needed to be provided at that time. Restitution needed to be made at that time. But that blood and that blood of those bulls and those goats could not take away the sin, and it had to be repeated and repeated and repeated. Verse 5, therefore, when he comes into the world, he says, sacrifice and offering you have not desired, but a body you have prepared for me, and a whole burnt offering and sacrifices for sin you have taken no pleasure. Then I said, behold, I have come, in the scroll of the book it is written of me, to do your will, O God. So sacrifices and offering you have not desired, and whole burnt offering and sacrifices for sin you have taken no pleasure. Okay, so why did we just spend the last hour covering this? Why were they put in place? If he has no desire in them, then why did he establish them? I think it's better to read that it's not so question of he didn't want them to happen. Is that he takes no pleasure, and here he's speaking specifically of the sin offerings here, and the need to have a burnt offering, to have reconciliation, to atone through a sacrifice, he takes no pleasure. Because that's not what God is looking for in the end. Let's look back at Psalms chapter 40. Psalms chapter 40 and verse 6. Psalms chapter 40 and verse 6. He was quoting from David's psalm. Sacrifice and meal offering you have not desired. My ears you have not opened. My ears you have opened. Burnt offering and sin offering you have not required. Then I said, behold, I come. In the scroll of the book it is written of me, I delight to do your will, O my God. Your law is within my heart. Here David summarizes in two verses these sacrifices and God's desire and what God desires. God does not take pleasure in these sacrifices, but they are required. To repeat, sin separates us. We need something to reconcile us to God. While God does not take pleasure or have desire on these sacrifices and offerings, they're required. They're mandatory. But that's not what God is looking for. As we're reading, as we just read with David, is he's looking for us to do his will. He is looking for our heart. It's like Micah. Let's look. Turn back to Micah. Micah chapter 6. Micah 6 verse 6. With what shall I come before the Eternal and bow myself before the God on high? Shall I come to him with burnt offerings, with yearling calves? Does the Lord take delight in thousands of rams and 10,000 rivers of oil, or pounds and tons of flour, or skies filled with turtle doves? Shall I present my firstborn for my rebellious acts, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has told you, O man, what is good, and what does the Eternal require of you, but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God. These sacrifices are mandatory. But they're for a purpose. They should drive us to something. Obviously, first, reconciliation, atonement, a pursuit of offering our first fruits to those in need, of an attitude, a desire of sacrifice, of sojourning as a congregation, as a desire to do His will and to preach His gospel, to bring many sons to glory. That's what God delights in. The sacrifices are a tool for us to help us to get there. Because if we're separated from God, if we don't have an attitude or desire of atonement, we're not much use to Him. If we don't have that humility of willing to be a sacrifice to each other, that humility of willing to be taught and able to be taught, we're not much use. The sacrifices were required, not desired, by God because of the old covenant. That He wants the law in our hearts. Christ's sacrifice now replaces that imperfect sacrificial system. It replaces that penalty of death, of blood needing to be paid. However, He still wants our delight in doing His will. Even with Christ's sacrifice, that's not where it ends. That we accept Jesus Christ as our Savior, we're done. No, the law in our hearts is what He desires. Just as David wrote, those physical sacrifices is not what God desired. Even Christ's sacrifice, as critical, as important as it is, He still wants the law in our hearts. The spiritual application remains. Our active participation remains. We think about these five offerings, physical and as temporary as they are, they help teach us to point to where we need to be. The burnt offering, a free will dedication of ourselves to God's atonement. During this Passover time, it's time to renew. We don't have to wait for Passover season, but it's an optimum time for us to reflect and think that just like that burnt sacrifice was a whole sacrifice. Is that reflective of our desire to be at one with God? The meal offering, a sharing of our first fruits, of our physical blessings as well as our talented blessings. The peace offering, fellowshipping with God and His saints and ourselves. A lot's been covered on that the last few weeks, and so I won't belabor that point. The sin offering, Christ's sacrifice for our sins, unintentional against His will, and then the trespass offerings. Christ's sacrifice is there to bring reconciliation, but also a need for restitution. As we read, where in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus Christ said, if you're here at the altar with your offering, and you need to make restitution, it's time to go make restitution before you finish your offering. The restitution was required under the Old Testament, as we read, under the Old Covenant. The restitution was required when the offering was presented. If you think we're going to present spiritually, or want Christ to cover our sacrifice, our transgression against our brother, and we have not sought restitution or provided restitution, that's not the full sacrifice. It's both together. As we think about this Passover time and Christ's sacrifice, it is so special to us and what it means. What Christ is willing to go through for our benefit, to be beaten beyond recognition, to endure what He endured. It's through the love of us that we can be restored, that we can be atoned to our Creator. It's so precious. It's so important to us as Christians. But we can learn from those physical sacrifices. We don't have to do them anymore. But we can learn from what they teach us in our lives, in our spiritual lives, so that we can in turn become a sacrifice, a Christian spiritual sacrifice ourselves. Have a good Passover season.